The U.S. Secretary of State says Washington will return to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal once Tehran meets its commitments to the accord. The U.S. Federal Reserve Chief says the spike in COVID-19 cases in the country is hampering economic recovery from the downturn caused by the pandemic. Also ahead, the Pan American Health Organization says over 1 million people in the Americas have now died from the novel coronavirus complications. Welcome to World News. We're live from our headquarters in the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. Our top story, the U.S. Secretary of State says Washington will return to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal when Tehran goes back to full compliance with the accord. Antony Blinken made the comment during his first press briefing at the State Department. The White House has said it would hold talks with its allies regarding the nuclear agreement, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Former U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned the deal in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Tehran. In return, Iran reduced some of its commitments under the JCPOA, citing the remaining signatories' failure to uphold their end of the bargain. The Islamic Republic has repeatedly rejected any precondition for the U.S. to rejoin the agreement, saying it will return to full compliance only after Washington lifts the economic sanctions. Political commentator John Bosnich says the ball is in the U.S. court to return to its commitments under the Iran nuclear deal, as Washington was the first to violate the agreement.
Under normal circumstances, Iran's position is entirely legal and entirely standard policy. However, we know that these are not normal circumstances because you're dealing with the United States of America. I had the distinct displeasure of dealing with the United States for 9.5 months when I was based in Japan and consulting with the Japanese government. And I can tell you it's no easy thing to achieve. But Japan's first position must be, first, the violation of the accord must be corrected by the party that violated it. And once the violation is corrected, then anything else is discussable.
Iran warns Israel that it will hit Israeli cities and missile bases if Tel Aviv makes a mistake by carrying out its military threats against Tehran.
Israelis must know that if they make the slightest mistake, the cities of Tel Aviv and Haifa will be razed to the ground on the basis of remarks made by the leader of the Islamic Revolution. Based on the strategies of the Islamic Republic, the collapse of Israel is on the agenda. Iran and regional nations will not back down on their demand for the collapse of Israel. There is no way other than ousting the cancerous tumor of Israel from the region.
The spokesman made the remarks after an Israeli general said the regime is refreshing operational plans against Iran. The Iranian military official dismissed Aviv Kohavi's remarks as an illusion and psychological warfare. He noted that such remarks could also be based on the fact that Israel is not aware of Iran's military might. The latest Israeli rhetoric against Iran comes as the new U.S. administration has signaled it wants to re-enter the 2015 nuclear deal. Tel Aviv has frequently threatened the Islamic Republic with strikes over its nuclear program. Political commentator Mustafa Khoshchesh says the U.S. and Israeli threats against Iran are hollow and boastful, and that any attacks on the Islamic Republic won't be left unanswered.
Now, after triple incidents last year, shooting down the Global Hawk, and especially the masterpiece, which was Iranian missile attack on Ain al-Assad, when the commander-in-chief of the United States, President Donald Trump, threatened to strike back 52 Iranian centers, and he never did that, then their hollow and boastful threats proved to be empty, hollow completely, without any credibility. So what should Biden do in order to advance this containment strategy? They have asked at least for the past 1 year, they have asked the Israelis to step forward and to help them through posing threats to Iran, military threats to Iran, in order to claim that, okay, if crazy Donald Trump is gone, now the crazy Netanyahu is still there, and he would go for the military threats. But in essence, all throughout the last one and a half years, what have they been doing? They have been claiming that they've been striking Iran in Syria. 95% has been no more than lies. But for the 5% they did something to Iranian allies, they have surely received their response. The Israelis remember pretty well what happened to them in the Golan Heights, and they remember the number of casualties they had in there.
The United States has temporarily frozen planned arms sales to the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia for review. A State Department spokesperson said the move is aimed at ensuring the sales meet Washington's strategic objectives with regard to its partners. The frozen deals include a $23 billion package of F-35 jets to the UAE. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration agreed to the deal after the UAE normalized its relations with Israel. The U.S. has also been preparing major sales of munitions to Saudi Arabia. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in his Senate confirmation session that the Saudi onslaught on Yemen has contributed to the dire humanitarian situation in the country. Political analyst Brian Terrell says the U.S. is concerned about its own strategic objectives rather than the lives of Yemenis.
Well, I think this is it's a very positive change that we have a president now who understands that the COVID-19 pandemic and climate change are real things, need to be dealt with. But what we're seeing is a return to normal, and as reassuring as that might be, we need to remember how bad normal was, and that this war in Yemen began under the Obama administration when now President Biden was vice president of the United States. I'm concerned over Secretary Blinken's saying that it's advances to our strategic objectives that this review is going to be based on. And not consideration for the people of Yemen who's are facing humanitarian disaster that Mr. Blinken is talking about as well. This is in the United States, the big arms manufacturers like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, they don't just follow U.S. policies; they make them.
And U.S. stocks have suffered their sharpest daily decline in months as the Federal Reserve says the COVID-19 surge is hampering economic recovery from the downturn caused by the pandemic. The Dow Jones fell 2.1%, while the broad-based S&P 500 and the tech-rich Nasdaq Composite Index were down 2.6%. This was the biggest daily percentage slump of the three since late October 2020. Stocks had been in the red all day, but losses deepened during a news conference by the Federal Reserve Chair. Jerome Powell warned that the U.S. economic outlook was, quote, highly uncertain in light of a spike in the country's coronavirus cases. He said around 9 million people remain unemployed as a result of the pandemic. Economic analyst Jack Rasmus says the U.S. economy is in a very unstable situation.
In terms of the real economy, we're going to see very soon that the fourth quarter GDP in the U.S. slowed dramatically from the third quarter. And, of course, the third quarter only recovered about 60% of the collapse of the first half of last year. And the first quarter this year, 2021, looks even worse. So the U.S. economy is in a very unstable situation. I'm talking about the real economy, not the stock markets yet. I will. And then, of course, COVID is raging here. We've got 100,000 people a month that are dying. And yes, they're trying to get this COVID vaccine out, but it's they're finding great difficulties because after a year with no planning, No program for distributing this. The whole distribution is a shambles, and they're trying to get that put together again.
The Pan-American Health Organization says over 1 million people in the Americas have now died from the novel coronavirus complications. The head of the organization, Carissa Etienne, warned that in some U.S. states, nearly 80% of ICU beds are being used to treat COVID-19 patients, and similar rates are seen in many Mexican states. She also said the hospital situation in Brazil is particularly worrisome, with 3/4 of ICU beds occupied in many states. The U.S. is the worst hit country in the world, with nearly 25.6 million cases and more than 428,000 deaths. Brazil is the second worst affected state on the continent, with some 9 million cases and nearly 219,000 deaths. Now, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security declares a nationwide terrorism alert, citing a potential threat from domestic anti-government extremists opposed to Democratic Joe Biden as president. The alert, which is the first ever issued for domestic violent extremists, said the threat of attacks could persist for weeks. It added that extremists emboldened by the deadly January 6 assault on Congress could undertake attacks against elected officials and government facilities. On Monday, the Pentagon said thousands of troops deployed in Washington would remain in the capital through March due to FBI intelligence on potential threats. The attack on the Capitol was carried out by angry protesters who rejected the outcome of the November 2020 presidential election. U.S. officials say the protesters were incited by former President Donald Trump. Staying in the U.S., where aerospace giant Boeing has recorded the largest net loss in its history after delaying the delivery of the all-new 777X jet again. The company said it expects the wide-body plane to enter service by late 2023. Delaying the jet's entry for the third time, it cited diminished demand because of the coronavirus pandemic, as well as tougher certification requirements after its 737 MAX safety crisis. It booked a $6.5 billion charge as a result of the postponement. This pushed Boeing's fourth quarter loss to $8.4 billion, plunging its tally for all of 2020 to $11.9 billion. This is a nearly 19-fold increase compared to the previous year's record of $636 million. As part of its cost-cutting plans, the manufacturer has announced job cuts of up to 30,000 employees over 2 years. In the UK, the COVID-19 pandemic has taken 100,000 lives. This makes it the fifth and smallest country to enter a six-figure death toll. The government is under fire for its handling of the pandemic. But while taking full responsibility for the situation, the country finds itself in nearly a year after the pandemic hit. The Prime Minister has defended his party's decisions.
The United Kingdom was the first to detect a more contagious and perhaps more deadly COVID-19 variant. It was also the first country to start vaccinating and has now inoculated most of its over 80s, more than 6.5 million people. Nonetheless, Boris Johnson's government is under fire for its handling of the pandemic, as the UK's death toll passes 100,000.
The Prime Minister was slow into the first lockdown last March. He was slow in getting protective equipment to the front line, slow to protect our care homes, slow on testing and tracing, slow into the second lockdown in the autumn, slow to change the Christmas mixing rules, slow again into this third lockdown, delaying 13 days from the 22nd of December before implementing it.
The government has taken responsibility for the death toll, but defended its decisions, some of which were pumping billions of pounds into a new test and trace system that has failed dismally, the launching of the Eat Out to Help Out scheme, which doctors blame for the autumn surge in infections, and refusing to clamp down on air travel that continued without testing or quarantine upon arrival.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, there will indeed be a time when we must learn the lessons of what has happened, reflect on them, and prepare, Mr. Speaker. I don't think that moment is now, when we are in the throes of fighting this wave of the new variant, when 37,000 people are struggling with COVID in our hospitals. And I think what the country wants is for us to come together as a parliament and as politicians.
The UK entered the pandemic unprepared, with a defunded and ailing National Health Service, cuts to public spending, and one of the highest rates of obesity in the world. Millions of Britons who were already struggling before the pandemic are pinning their hopes now on the vaccine. The government says some restrictions may be lifted by late February, but if anything, the new variant has shown that this is a marathon, not a sprint. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Elsewhere, hundreds of people have been injured as the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli witnesses a third consecutive night of protests against a strict coronavirus lockdown. Lebanese media reported that 266 protesters and security forces were injured during the clashes. Security personnel fired tear gas and used water cannon to disperse the angry crowd of mostly youth who threw rocks and set garbage bins on fire in Tripoli's main square. Lebanese people are frustrated with the tight coronavirus restrictions. The government imposed a full round-the-clock lockdown earlier this month in order to curb the spike in COVID-19 cases. The pandemic has exacerbated the country's already crippling economic crisis. And COVID-19 infections in Gaza are on the rise amid a fragile health system. The impoverished Gaza Strip lacks many resources to combat the coronavirus pandemic due to the crippling Israeli blockade. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon brings us more from the besieged enclave.
The Gaza Strip has logged more than 50,000 COVID-19 infections and over 500 deaths, mostly since late August 2020. The unsteady supply of medical equipment and testing kits for COVID-19 has compounded the struggle of health workers in Gaza, undermining their efforts to contain and track the spread of the coronavirus. Under-equipped hospitals in the blockaded Gaza Strip are already overwhelmed by the increasing number of coronavirus patients. Rights groups warn that Gaza is facing a catastrophic situation.
The Israeli blockade in place for 14 years has had a catastrophic impact on Gaza's health sector. Currently, the entire health system here is fragile and unable to deal with the coronavirus pandemic. The health situation is alarming, especially the number of deaths amongst the coronavirus patients.
The coronavirus has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip, and people fear the worst because of the high population density.
Everyone is afraid of this deadly virus that has wreaked havoc all over the world. I'm really worried about the health of my family because the coronavirus is very contagious.
We are extremely worried because the health system in Gaza is very weak. The situation is especially scary when it comes to children and elderly people being infected.
Despite the increasing number of COVID-19 infections in Gaza, the Israeli regime still refuses to allow coronavirus vaccines into the Gaza Strip. This comes while Israel has vaccinated close to 30% of its citizens.
The Israeli blockade has devastated the health system in Gaza, especially with lack of medicines and hospital supplies. The situation is only getting worse as Israel, as an occupying power, refuses to allow coronavirus vaccines from reaching the Gaza Strip.
As coronavirus infections continue to rise, experts are calling for the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade to help fight the spread of the deadly pandemic.
Gaza's health system has been battered by the Israeli blockade and multiple wars since 2007 under the international community's watch. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away. This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A study released recently by Barcelona's Hospital del Mar looking at the impact of the spring's COVID-19 surge on more than 9,000 healthcare workers across Spain found that at least 28% suffered major depression. Dr. Jordi Alonso, one of the chief researchers, said that it is six times higher than the rate in the general population before the pandemic. We now present you a news report written by Renate Brito. The piece is titled Spain's Virus Surge Hits Mental Health of Frontline Workers. The news report has been published by the Associated Press News Agency. Please stay with us for more of Renate Brito's news report. The unrelenting increase in COVID-19 infections in Spain following the holiday season is again straining hospitals, threatening the mental health of doctors and nurses who have been at the forefront of the pandemic for nearly a year. In Barcelona's Hospital del Mar, the critical care capacity has more than doubled and is nearly full, with 80% of the intensive care unit beds occupied by coronavirus patients. Dr. José Ramón Masclans, who heads the intensive care unit, said, "There are young people of 20-something years old and older people of 80 years old, all the age groups," he added. "This is very difficult, and it is one patient after another." Even though authorities allowed gatherings of up to 10 people for Christmas and the New Year celebrations, Dr. José Masclans chose not to join his family and spent the holidays at home with his friend. He said, "We did it to preserve our health and the health of others. And when you see that this isn't being done by others, it causes significant anger, added to the fatigue." A study released recently by Hospital del Mar in Barcelona, looking at the impact of the spring's COVID-19 surge on more than 9,000 healthcare workers across Spain, found that at least 28% suffered from major depression. Dr. Jordi Alonso, one of the chief researchers, said that it is six times higher than the rate in the general population before the pandemic. In addition, the study found that nearly half of the participants had a high risk of anxiety, a high risk of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, panic attacks, or substance and alcohol abuse problems. Spanish healthcare workers are far from the only ones to have suffered psychologically from the coronavirus pandemic. According to the World Health Organization, WHO, in China, the levels of mental disorders among doctors and nurses were even higher, with 50% reporting depression, 45% reporting anxiety, and 34% reporting insomnia. In the United Kingdom, a survey released recently by the Royal College of Physicians found that 64% of British doctors reported feeling tired or exhausted. One in four sought out mental health support. Dr. Andrew Goddard, president of the Royal College of Physicians, said in a statement accompanying the study, "It is pretty awful at the moment in the world of medicine." The statement added, "Hospital admissions are at their highest ever level. Staff are exhausted, and although there is light at the end of the tunnel, that light seems a long way away." Dr. Alex Carmona, a third-year anesthesiology resident in Spain's northeastern region of Catalonia, didn't have much intensive care unit experience before the coronavirus pandemic hit. But as surgeries were cancelled, Dr. Alex Carmona was summoned to the intensive care unit at the Moises Brogui Hospital outside Barcelona to fight a virus the world knew very little about. Dr. Carmona recalled, "In the beginning, we had a lot of adrenaline. We were very frightened, but we had a lot of energy." He ploughed through the first weeks of the pandemic without having much time to process the unprecedented battle that was unfolding. It wasn't until after the second month that Dr. Alex Carmona began feeling the toll of seeing firsthand how people were slowly dying as they ran out of breath. He pondered what to tell patients before intubating them. His initial reaction had always been to reassure them, tell them it will be all right, but in some cases he knew that wasn't true. Dr. Carmona said, "I started having difficulty sleeping and a feeling of anxiety before each shift," adding, "I would return home after 12 hours feeling like I had been beaten up." For a while, he could only sleep with the help of medication. Some colleagues started taking antidepressants and anti-anxiety drugs. What really helped Carmona, though, was a support group at his hospital, where his co-workers unloaded the experiences they had bottled up inside. But not everyone joined the group. For many, asking for help would make them seem unfit for the job. David Oliver, a spokesman for the Catalonia chapter of the SATSA Union of Nurses, said, "In our profession, we can handle a lot." He added, "We don't want to take time off because we know we will add to the workload of our colleagues." According to the study, the most affected group of healthcare workers were nurses' aides and nurses, who are overwhelmingly women and often immigrants. They spent more time with dying COVID-19 patients facing poor working conditions and salaries and feared infecting their family members. Desiree Ruiz is the nurse supervisor at Hospital del Mar in Barcelona's critical care unit. Some nurses on her team have asked to take time off work, unable to cope with the constant stress and all the deaths in the hospital. To prevent infections, patients are rarely allowed family visits, adding to their dependency on nurses. Desiree Ruiz said delivering a patient's last wishes or words to relatives on the phone is especially challenging. She said, "This is very hard for people who are holding the hand of these patients, even though they know they will end up dying." Desiree Ruiz, who organizes the nurses' shifts and makes sure the intensive care unit is always staffed adequately, is finding it harder and harder to do so. Unlike in the summer, when the number of cases fell and healthcare workers were encouraged to take their holidays, doctors and nurses have been working incessantly since autumn, when coronavirus cases picked up again. The latest resurgence has nearly doubled the number of daily cases seen in November, and Spain now has the third highest COVID-19 infection rate in Europe and the fourth highest death toll in Europe, with more than 50,400 confirmed fatalities. But unlike many European countries, including neighboring Portugal, the Spanish health minister has for now ruled out the possibility of a new lockdown, relying instead on less drastic restrictions that aren't as damaging to Spain's economy, but take longer to decrease the rate of infections. Dr. Yordi Alonso fears the later surge of coronavirus patients could be as detrimental to the mental health of medical staff as the shock of the pandemic's first months. He said, "If we want to be cared for adequately, we also need to take care of the healthcare workers who have suffered and are still suffering."
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and let us present you a supplication to the Lord Most High by the Holy Prophet's Immaculate Daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. O Allah, by your knowledge of the unseen and your power over creation, keep me alive so long as you know that life is good for me, and cause me to die when death is good for me.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar, Allahu Akbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in qarn mojiza kardid, millat Iran, millat mojiza asay qarn ast.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience. Particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World, and as I say, also shaped all our tomorrows. This program is about the life and times, the biographical account of Imam Khomeini. May God bless him and may his soul rest in peace. The leader, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution here in Iran. And, of course, we are going through the second phase of the life and times of Imam Khomeini, and this is in regard to his exile back in 1963. And with me in the studio to discuss that very phase is Sayyid Taqi Razavi, who is from the Holy Seminaries of Qum, a very renowned scholar. Salam, hello, and welcome, Sayyidina. And thank you very much for giving us your valuable time today.
Alaykum salam. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Great. Sayyidina, we were at that point discussing about some of the great characteristics and virtues of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his and rest his soul. We were talking about the fact that he was very determined to deal with the situation here in Iran, because certainly in terms of the oppression from the Pahlavi regime, And we're now talking about, of course, Raza Khan, which was Muhammad Raza's father, who was installed since the 1920s, as you mentioned before. And, of course, he was trying to promote an agenda which was very similar to that of Atatürk we discussed in Turkey, where he was trying to secularize Iran and remove religion from the people. But he was doing it in such a way that there was a considerable oppression of the clergy in particular. So we moved to the 60s, and we were mentioning about the fact that since the time of Mossadegh, since in 1953, where Mossadegh and Ayatollah Kashani's movement in terms of nationalizing the oil industry, about trying to make it a republic or an Islamic republic, but the movement didn't last. It was the coup d'etat done by the CIA, by the Americans, established the son of Raza Khan, which was Muhammad Raza Pahlavi, as the ultimate and king of kings, we can say, of the region, not only of Iran, but of the entire Middle East. And, of course, they had, through him, strengthened their relations with the Zionist regime, because we know that round about this time, of course, you know, the Arabs were having their Yom Kippur War, as they called it, with Egypt. And, of course, Iran was helping the Zionist regime at that time through the Raza Shah Pahlavi. And, of course, Imam Khomeini spoke out about that. I mean, he certainly was, you know, these were the things that he was highlighting to the public, that, you know, here we are supporting the very enemy of Islam in the heartland of the region. So we're now on to the second phase where, you know, the Shah has, you know, after that very powerful speech that he gave in the Fezia, the Hawza here in Qom, and, you know, the soldiers went in and, you know, we know of the atrocities that were then committed in the Hawza Fezia, where, you know, clergy were literally thrown off the rooftops and were martyred. And, you know, the whole Hawza Fezia was ransacked by the soldiers. And, of course, as you see, within a couple of days, Imam Khomeini was sent out of Iran. So I'd like you to speak now a bit about the exile, about this very important phase of Imam Khomeini's life, especially the 14 years in Najaf, where he was participating in the Grand Hawza there, giving lectures and seminars on his own right, because we now discuss the fact that he was also a Marja'i Taqlid as well. So could you enlighten us further as to what that phase of his life was about and how important it was in shaping future events?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In fact, the events of Fezia, which were pertaining to Imam's initial removal from Qom, because he didn't right from the outset be removed from Qom and Iran. He was in fact taken out of Qom
right. And
passed from pillar to post to different prisons and things
right.
in
Iran. Right, okay, so there was the prison period
indeed,
as well.
Indeed,
there's
a
right.
period of
right.
prison imprisonment and people's revolts and
sure.
people's want for him to be released and so on.
Yes,
I mean, after 19 days after the events of Ashura, which was on the 6th of June, which is known as the regular Khodad demonstrations and things, which take place
right.
on the 14th of Khodad,
right.
a regular event which is renowned here as of that particular event on the 3rd of June 1963.
Right.
He was taken away after that event
right.
and imprisoned. I mean, 19 days afterwards, he was imprisoned in Khalsa prison.
Right.
And thereupon, he was moved to different places.
This prison was in Tehran, was it?
It is in Tehran.
Yeah,
and then
Tehran.
He was taken to a military base where he was kept
right.
for a while.
Right.
So this whole process of him being back in Qom and away type of thing,
right.
it took a whole of almost 5 months.
Right.
It was from the 3rd of June till the 4th of November, 64. In fact, 1 year and 5 months.
Right.
A whole 1 year had taken place over
right,
that
right.
Process of time. And you see Imam Khomeini, and there are a lot of riots and demonstrations taking place for his release. And at the final straw was August of 1964, when Shah was continuing to make pro-American gestures.
Of course.
And strong
yes.
pro-American gestures.
Yep, yep.
and particularly in autumn of 1964, when they passed the law that an American person could even kill an Iranian, but he would not be judged here in Iran, he would have to go to America.
Sure.
That Imam Khomeini made his final bash for the Shah of that time, you know. Yeah.
And this also comes with the backdrop that, of course, the Pahlavi regime in 1961, under the auspices of John F. Kennedy at the time, under that administration, he was bringing in the so-called White Revolution.
Indeed, that White Revolution, in fact, they again used it against the ulema.
Yes, it was against the clergy.
The clergies were against the White Revolution. The White Revolution was trying to give the ordinary man an opportunity, whilst the ulema were working with the big people and gangsters, so as to say, of the time, and they were kind of trying to tune public against them. Mm-hmm. But the main thing which Imam Khomeini did have a strong word for was this thing about the Americans who could commit crimes in Iran against the Iranian people, mm-hmm. and have impunity in reality.
Yeah, it was complete immunity. Immunity and
release from any. To the fact that Imam Khomeini said that a cook of the American embassy could come and kick the Shah in the teeth, and the Shah could not do anything
about it.
Yeah. You know, so as to say, you know, the most petite personnel of the American embassy could do whatever
complete
they could
humiliation.
With the absolute authority of Iran.
Sure,
so you
sure.
can see Imam Khomeini was really out for it on this particular issue.
Yeah, yeah.
But the Majlis was really keen to have it going. The Parliament
of
America of Iran, which was obviously fully dominated by pro-American, pro-Western stooges of the Shah,
sure.
and of course their own personal kickbacks that they as politicians were getting,
sure.
Were out to make this law permanent.
Yes, I mean the Majlis's function at that time was simply to ratify whatever the Shah had to
Indeed.
Say.
Yeah. So, whilst in autumn of 64 this was going on and Imam sure. Khomeini was making his stand against it, this was the last tour for the Shah.
Right.
He gets him arrested in 1964,
4th
of November.
Right.
And the following, or on that same day, or the morning of that day, whatever it may be, he was taken to the airport and sent off to Turkey.
Turkey, yes.
And there he was looked after in Turkey by a Turkish general. And of course, why Turkey was selected was because of the fact that Shah hoped that because Turkey had no ulema ruled there,
that's
in the
right.
sense ulema could not walk around
that's
with
right.
with their turban or religious symbols or anything, that his whole concept would subdue there, and cease to exist.
Well, there's a black and white photograph of Imam Khomeini wandering around in Istanbul, and he's just wearing an overcoat, and there's no religious regalia
Indeed.
Of any kind.
And that's what his aspiration was, that in this process of time, in his exile in Turkey.
Yeah, this will pacify him somehow.
He'll die out, in the sense the whole concept of Imam Khomeini's stand against
but,
certain...
But then circumstances changed, didn't they?
Indeed, circumstances changed because Imam Khomeini wanted to be back into his lecturing capacity, wanted to be back with the ulema of the time, wanted to be in the schools and be teaching.
Back into Hoza again,
Indeed,
of course.
Teaching whoever he felt were able to be his future idealists.
Right.
The
so
future.
How did he manage to get back to
Well,
Najaf?
What happened in that that on the 5th of September 65? I mean, he didn't stay in Turkey
for long,
hardly a year.
Right.
He leaves Turkey and goes off for Najaf. Where he spends the next 13 years of his time.
That's right.
So this 14 years exile is a year, just under a year in Turkey, and then the rest of the 13 years
is
in
Iraq. Right.
And of course, not as such in Iraq, in the sense he's then forced out by Iraq in the latter part of the 70s, where he's in Kuwait and then goes off to France.
Sure.
But that's a whole story in itself.
Itself, yes, of course.
The last year is that very important phase of his pre-revolution phase.
It's interesting that he's coming into Najaf at the backdrop of one of the most cruel coups in Iraq at that time, which was the coming of the Ba'athist regime in 1958. And, you know, he's coming at a backdrop of this murderous regime that comes in. How does he manage to survive that exile there?
This is Islamic history.
Yeah.
You see, you had Imam Muhammad Baqir al-Islam and Imam Jafar Sadiq al-Islam being the best promoters of the fiqh of Imam, the fiqh of the Shiite opinion during the time when the Bani Abbasis and the Bani Umayyah are fighting for it. You know, so that fight of the enemy gives the opportunity for the best to come out.
That's right.
You know, they're fighting amongst themselves. What happened when Imam Khomeini settled himself in Najaf?
Mm.
He started teaching in Sheikh Ansari's madrasa. Sheikh Murtaza Ansari, who's a very prominent. In fact, Sheikh Ansari changed the whole principles of fiqh and laid down very important principles of jurisprudence in his own time.
Right.
And that madrasa was obviously quite a prominent madrasa within the Shia communities.
Yes.
Theological teachings.
I mean, this is the elite we are talking about here in Najaf. Yes.
So he settles in there and starts delivering lectures of various types, both jurisprudential lectures, as well as the fact, the very principle that he wants to set up a future identity of Islamic movement, identity
of Islamic
society. You see, what was very important in this period of time is not only is Imam Khomeini promoting the whole concept of Shia teaching, but he's also interpreting it to be a practical performance, a practically performed theory for the people.
Yes,
you know, it's not just an ordinary theory of the books.
It was a practical outline of how it was going to work.
Indeed. He was trying to put to work all those Islamic theories into a practical application for the people.
Exactly.
So what he was really trying to do was he was trying to put the theories into a definition of what we as a layman would say political application of religion.
Right.
And that was very important, what Imam Khomeini, because from the outset Imam Khomeini had been in the political arena of what was happening, even though the enemies, his enemies have always endeavored to say, why don't you stay in the mosque, why don't you stay in the madrasas, why don't you just do the teaching. He had always been out front line. Taking on political issues which were affecting the community.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you see what the enemies of the Islamic movement have always tried to do is to separate politics from religion. Imam Khomeini dragged it in, screaming and shouting, so as to say, the word politics into religion, even though the enemies attempted to pull it out.
As you quite rightly say, Imam Khomeini was unique in that sense that he comes out as a firebrand with simply pointing out the fact it's not Islam. You know, if we're not talking about politics, we're not talking about Islam at all.
No, I mean, one of the main things that the principles of Imam Khomeini's concepts was this, that the laws of society should be made according to Shariat law.
Exactly.
I mean, in on the basis of how God defines the application of people's lives.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really then ordinary. It doesn't mean just the fact that the lead, the authority should be a religious authority.
Mm.
It means that religious authority should be in everyday life of the people.
Exactly.
That's what he was trying to conjure up in people's understanding.
That's right.
Hey, you don't need an authority with a stick.
No.
You need a stick to be the part of the whole system. Where so much so that people realize that they have a responsibility to each other, not only as personal interaction, but as a religious interaction.
Yeah.
In other words, for example, I could say as an ethical discussion, we could say is that, for example, a father, when he goes out working for the livelihood of his children, he shouldn't feel that he's doing a favor for his children, but he has a responsibility from the Almighty to do that for the kids.
That's right. That's
so
right.
That attitude Imam Khomeini wants to bring home, that everything that a society does, it should do with the aspiration that it is to fulfill God's obedience. And God's instructions.
Exactly.
And that is what Imam Khomeini is nurturing in these discussions. Of course, he goes to a very high level where he's defining the role of a walayat al-faqih, in other words, the authority of a jurisprudence in the absence of the 12th Imam.
Yeah.
But in reality, he's trying to nurture a society of religious practices.
Exactly.
But by defining the absolute authority in that system.
Exactly.
And he does it very well. Mm-hmm. And he does it on, you know, the whole concept, this whole concept is developed in front of students, particularly in the 70s.
Yeah. Yep.
Early 70s in Najaf, where he's lecturing in this madrasa, and he's talking about the meaning of Hukumat Islami.
Exactly.
Islamic
government. This is the two big famous works that come out of those houses. The first is the Gnosis, the one that is the Jihad al-Akbar, the one that is to, you know, for that responsibility to be carried out properly by, as you say, a walayat al-faqih, a supreme jurist. He's got to have that training, that discipline to get rid of his nafs-e-amara, to be the example, the lead by which you look at him, in like fact, many hadiths, as they say, by the Holy Prophet, that you just by looking at him, you are reminded of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
In fact, you're making a very good link here, brother. The fact that, you know, Imam Khomeini is the only marja taqlid who says that in his line of conditions, yes, that a person qualifies for marja taqlid, is that he says one of the attributes of such a person,
yes,
should be that he should not have the desire for the world.
Exactly.
Once they add that etiyat wajib, that cautious compulsory caution, is the only one found in Imam Khomeini's rulings. It's not found in any other Maraja's ruling where it says etiyat wajib, he should not have worldly desires. That is a very interesting. Imam Khomeini is saying, even if you come to the level of a marja taqlid, the shaitan can come home to you.
Exactly.
But you should kick him out.
Kick him out.
And the only way to do that is, as a marja taqlid, you should not have this character in your heart either.
Aye.
You shouldn't think, okay, I'm becoming a marja taqlid, wow, I'm going to have so many people following me.
Absolutely, yes, okay? But no.
That immediately is that world's desire, which Imam Khomeini reprimands. And this is a very good link you're making between the ethical discussions that Imam Khomeini develops in his 40.
And then this position of walaya.
And this position of wilayah. Because with the discussion of the wilayat al-faqih, I mean, this is a very important issue which Imam Khomeini, through his teachings, raises people like Shaykh Sadr from it.
Yes.
You know, Shaykh Sadr is that last component of his teachings, who was shaheed in Iraq.
He says,
kind of drown yourself in Khomeini.
Drown yourself.
In one of his speeches, drown yourself in Imam Khomeini. Mm. So, you know, it's that absoluteness that he has in recognizing Imam Khomeini's... and what was his age? He wasn't in his 70s or 80s. He was 48 years old.
Yes. You know, and I like that, what you raised there, that drowning also, because there's mystical poems from Imam Khomeini about drowning with the beloved, you know, because he's talking about nothing but Allah. It's not even about himself. He's just wanting to see that the system is in place, as you say, of a society of pious people who are carrying out these edicts according to the Sharia, but the whole goal is to be with the beloved, isn't it?
Indeed. But then you see, being with the beloved doesn't mean that you abrogate all responsibilities for the world.
No, it this doesn't. It's putting it all in
focus.
But you
see, this is what is important, is to understand. Now, whilst Imam Khomeini was an advocate of mysticism, he was not an advocate of excommunication.
Excommunication, from the world. We're not talking about
that. You see, because Imam Khomeini, throughout his poetical presentation of coming close to God, was not that individual himself endeavors to come close to God. He should be a tool by which he could bring the society to God as well.
That's right.
And that's what Imam Khomeini replicated as being that manifestation of being that tool.
It's like putting everything in its right place, isn't it? Putting it all in the right context in terms of earning your money, going to your job, whatever it happens to be. But it's all, at the end of the day, to be in line with what is required to be a good Muslim.
Indeed. So coming back to this, that the role that Imam Khomeini was trying to conjure up in the minds of his students was that they should have this idea of leading the Muslim Ummah towards God by implementing God's rules.
Yes.
So when he's teaching these things in the Hausa, he's quite clearly in the seminaries, he's quite clearly bringing this home to people. And other than that, of course, he was also teaching philosophy, and that in itself was a big headache for some ulema. Some scholars of the time.
Right.
I mean, I remember in one of his statements, he says that when I was teaching philosophy, some of the students used to wash the bowl from which my son used to drink water from. In the sense that some people felt that teaching philosophy was kufr.
Oh my goodness.
It was an act of an insult to Islam.
My goodness.
Because of course they did not themselves
understand the fact
the level by which one is using philosophy in understanding God.
Exactly.
And in understanding philosophy, there is a lot of discussion that if you're not capable of extrapolating those meanings from philosophical arguments, then you rather not go down that line at all.
And because the aspect that why Imam Khomeini is using philosophy is to put the rationale behind the system he was going to put in place not only for what was happening in Iran, but for the whole Muslim world. I mean,
it was essential that through this, as you're pointing out, the rest of the world understands the character, the nature by which this movement is moving towards God.
Exactly.
You see, that
exactly.
Creator must be conceptualized in its entirety, in his entirety.
Yeah.
So much so that we could say that this hukuma, this government, is under his supervision. If that is not realized, then yet again, such a character of a vilayat-e faqih would be again a dictator.
Exactly. It would be completely misconstrued.
And that's why Imam Khomeini says that where there's an existence of the vilayat-e faqih, it's a tool of removal of dictatorship.
Well, the thing is, this is the beauty, isn't it, of what he's setting out in his exile and in terms of what he's preaching in Najaf. In the Hawza, although his immediate audience is the students, but he's going well beyond that to the masses and pointing out the fact that the people's participation in the system, they're saying yes to this system, removes the concept of dictatorship.
Yeah, but you see, what you're saying, people at that time were interested in knowing what Imam Khomeini was doing outside.
Yeah.
You see, more and more people, more and more of these lectures of Imam Khomeini were becoming cassettes and being smuggled into Iran.
That's right, yes.
They were
yes.
becoming articles.
They called it the cassette revolution, in a sense,
And they were being smuggled into it.
Yep.
In other words, people wanted to remember what Imam Khomeini was standing for. They weren't ignoring the fact that he's now in exile. He's another Majid Taqlid sitting in Najaf or something like that. No, the aspirations to connect with Imam Khomeini's thoughts were still there. And that's why, when, as you pointed out, it became a people's revolt in wanting Imam Khomeini back rather than Imam Khomeini's desire to be back
because
to lead.
They began to understand, you know, the ideology, the rationale by which Imam Khomeini was taking the stand against not only the Pahlavi regime, but he also pointed out, even while he was in Najaf, that even the criminals that were there in power there, he said, your turn will be next. You know, things like this, you know, there were comments that, you know, this was something that was really going to revolutionize the entire Muslim world.
In fact, what Imam Khamenei said in a lecture to the Islamic Awakening people, after the revolution, we expected Egyptians to revolt immediately. Because Imam Khomeini had sent a message of an ideological change.
Yeah.
A wave of ideological changes that were anticipated.
Yes.
But of course, we see it immediately after the revolution in Imam Khomeini, you had puppets like Anwar Sadat, who became an obstacle in these movements from coming to life.
Yep.
You had Mubarak after him, then you had Bin Ali in Tunisia. They all became obstacles once Imam Khomeini's movement came to its full essence.
Yeah, and this was only because, of course, Imam Khomeini, in a sense, by what he had done and the fact that he gave such a beautiful paradigm about how this system was going to function in Iran. Because this is the thing. This was what the unique thing that no other ulema and no other marja'i had done so far, was actually to come up with a model. Coming up with a model of how this system was actually going to function.
You see, Imam Khomeini was not really and truly creating something of his own.
No. But
Imam Khomeini, this whole concept...
He was putting the flesh onto
it,
wasn't he?
Not only just putting the flesh onto he was making people realize that this is not something out of the blue.
Yeah.
That it had always been within the theories of religious application
from
of
the school
society.
Of Ahlul Bayt, yes.
In the school of Ahlul Bayt, because of the fact that in the school of Ahlul Bayt, it did not neglect the fact that ulema would be a component in continuing the message of the Ahlul Bayt to the people.
There's a beautiful thing that you remind me of from Allama Mutahhari, Shaheed Mutahhari, one of the students of Imam Khomeini. Of course, he was martyred in the earlier years of the revolution by the Munafiqeen. And he points out beautifully three things that, you know, he was saying that the people needed in this day and age in order to make progress. And he said one of the things was that they need a school of thought that gives a progressive line in terms of understanding the concept of valaya, and through that valaya, the acceptance of that valaya, as it was in the past with the masumin, they have progress. They have prosperity and progress. And this was the thing that was so badly needed, because there was a vacuum in the Muslim world where many schools of thought were there but had reached a dead end because of various circumstances and various things that had happened. But briefly, Sayyidina, if you could say something about that, you in see, the last minute or see, so, what you're saying today.
Why he's absolutely right is the fact that Shiite opinion did not say that this leadership or the guidance of the ulama is something which is purely in the time of the occultation.
Yes.
During the absence of the 12th Imam.
Yeah.
In fact, it's been a process, which has successfully developed even in the time of Mawla Amir al-Mumineen Ali ibn Abi Talib's time.
Yes, yes.
You know, sometimes people say that the faqih or the jurisprudence has only responsibility in the absence of the imam. But no, in the presence of the imam, a jurist was active. Who was that jurist who was active? When Mawla Amir al-Mumineen Ali ibn Abi Talib sent Malik al-Ashtar to Misr, he sent the most prominent scholar of his time
exactly
to go to Misr and extrapolate on the